protesters arrested. Their eviction came tonight at midnight. They were told they would have to leave the park, and they decided to stay. They refused the city's offer to continue with the notice that they would have to be gone by a specific date. Since then, ten protesters have been arrested. The police are here with two bulldozers. They're just taking all the personal property. They're loading it into the back of dump trucks after telling us that it was going to be secured and available for pickup tomorrow. And they have SWAT police here. They have a tank. They have all kinds of just random craziness going on. And one protester was just allowed back in the park to remove their personal property after arguing with the cop about how they said they would be given that opportunity.
Sometimes. As you've just heard, Occupy Buffalo has been invaded by the police. Their encampment was shut down. Bulldozers and tanks showed up. I think I heard there was something like, well, I don't know how many police officers were, but they were set up for a riot, I guess. And it's a pretty lame eviction, though. I mean, the protester just kind of stood there and said, can we pick up our stuff? Take our laptops out of our tents and our personal belongings out of our tents before you take everything down. And the cops just said, no, we don't have time for that. So basically, it seems that it happened a little after 2 a.m., very early Thursday morning. February 2nd. Very early in the morning or late at night, however you want to view it. Their agreement with the city of Buffalo had expired. And so they had to move out of their encampment, and they knew this. They knew that their agreement was expiring, and they had the option of signing onto an agreement to extend until the beginning of March. But they didn't agree with what the city wanted them to agree with for that. So apparently about 10 people were arrested. The others agreed to move off of the encampment in Niagara Square so that they would not get arrested. I had a lot of mixed feelings about this. In some ways, very disappointed, discouraged, angry, but also I told you so because of some of the experiences I had at Occupy Buffalo. I think their group was sort of breaking down anyway. There was a lot of infighting. And people not getting along. I was censored when I tried to express some constructive criticism on their Facebook. Other people have been censored. Some people broke away from Occupy Buffalo, actually, and started a group called it Occupy Western New York, because the people at Occupy Buffalo said that they were disowning them. We're not going to include them anymore because the people who started Occupy Western New York wanted to occupy Lafayette Square, and they wanted to expand and occupy other areas. And they want, their idea is basically to own public space and maintain public spaces and bring back public space to the people, and not just have public space monopolized by a wealthy few, But Occupy Buffalo was so interested in compromising with the city and appeasing those in power in the city that they basically did not, they were so afraid of somehow getting in trouble with the city that they basically disowned these folks at Occupy Western New York. And also what ended up happening was other people got kicked out just for personality differences or just, you know, because people were doing things that some people running Occupy Buffalo didn't like. So there was just a lot of infighting, and, you know, it really just didn't make sense to me. I really feel that if you're going to call yourself a 99% movement, that you should be inclusive of people. So, you know, there was just a lot of stuff happening in Occupy Buffalo that kind of made me think that something was going to happen, that they were going to fall apart because of all the infighting that was happening there. So I have a lot of mixed feelings about it. I very strongly believe in public spaces, and I've written about it. I actually wrote a blog about it. I really think people should have the right to occupy public space, especially since so many people are losing their homes now. A lot of people are going to have to sleep out in tents. So the Occupy movements, I think, are important for that. And also, I think we need to be a bit more aggressive, not violent, but aggressive in addressing the government with our grievances. So I do believe in that stuff. And is there something? Oh, we've got a special guest on the show today, too. Can you hold that thought for 1 second?
Oh, okay.
Is that okay? Okay. Well, sure. A special guest, you want to say what your name is? She's a writer, very talented writer, locally here in Buffalo, writing about all kinds of exciting things. She's a vegetarian, right? Or are you
yes.
a vegan?
Nope.
Vegetarian? Does not eat anything that was alive other than veggies. Okay, so what was your...
My name is Mary Kozlowski, so you got that straight.
Do you want to say what your blog is?
I have various blogs. They're all in different... I've got about four. They're all niche blogs. You know, they're specific. A flash fiction blog, a makeup over 40 blog, a vegetarian, you know, in Buffalo blog, and the Angry Fish, which is at PisceanRant.blogspot.com, which is where, you know, I take on things that I'm noticing, you know, mm-hmm. happening around that are not too big to talk about in the space mm-hmm. of a single short blog post.
Would that be PisceanRant?
Piscean, yeah, PisceanRant. Yep.
Oh, Piscean.
Piscean.
As opposed to Piscean.
As
and.
No, no,
Piscean.
No.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, like the sign. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
I'm a Pisces, so it's called the Angry Fish. I wanted to ask you do you have any idea what the terms were that they didn't agree with in the new agreement to?
You know, I don't know the details. From what I understand, they were told that they could agree to stay until the beginning of March. And my understanding, and I could be wrong because the folks at Occupy Buffalo, honestly, I'm very, very pro the Occupy movement. I really am. But they were developing a kind of a clique there. And they're a little ultra paranoid about what other people say about them. And so I haven't been able to get a lot of people, you know, actively involved in the Occupy Buffalo movement to come on this show. I mean, they have been on in the past, of course, and of course I'm sort of Occupy Buffalo, you're Occupy Buffalo, we're all Occupy, we're all the 99%, but I'm just talking about, you know, what sort of transpired there is it's gotten very cliquish over there at Niagara Square.
Mm-hmm.
But what I understand is that they were told they would have to move out at the beginning of March, and that they didn't like that. It wasn't, they just didn't agree with that. Maybe, I don't know if it's that they decided they were going to stay permanently, they weren't going to agree to just leave at the beginning of March 1st, or they couldn't come to a consensus because they have these they have meetings where they get together and everyone votes on, theoretically, everyone is supposed to vote on these issues, and apparently they could not come to a consensus, is my understanding.
Mm-hmm.
But I admit I don't know all the details of it. If somebody else out there wanted to call in and, you know, and give us more information, that would be great. If somebody wants to come on the show and correct me and say, hey, you know, this is really what happened, hey, you know, I mean, this is you know, this is an independent show. This is not Fox News, so anyone can call in and express their opinions. But that's just my understanding is, mm-hmm. is it was just that simple. And apparently what had happened was when they had signed the agreement with the city in the first place, because essentially Occupy Buffalo was illegally camping in Niagara Square. So legally they weren't supposed to be there. But, you know, of course, the argument is, well, we need to change that law. It's not a good law, because why shouldn't people be able to camp out in a public space and address the government with grievances?
Yes.
So they were never really legally there, but the city came in and said, well, hey, we'll compromise with you. Mayor Byron Brown said, you know, we'll make a compromise, and you can sign this agreement, and then we won't kick you out in the winter, because I guess what was going to happen was they dumped snow in Niagara Square during the winter.
Yeah.
And so they were telling them, if we get a lot of snow, you'll have to leave and move to Lafayette Square.
Yeah.
Well, what ended up happening was they signed this agreement with the city to stay. But I guess the agreement said things like they had to follow ordinances, like, you know, just, the, you know, not have any fire hazards,
right, not
do not any
trash,
drugs, yeah.
this and that.
Right, and not abuse illegal drugs, and
right.
that was another thing, too. So they had certain, you know, ordinances and laws that they had to follow, and from what I understand, it was not a very complicated thing, but I guess what happened was people felt like it sort of legalized Occupy Buffalo and took away their rebelliousness, which was, I mean, their standpoint, which was supposed to be, we're not controlled by the government. You know, and I guess people felt like it was the government controlling them.
Well, you know, when you make a deal with it, you know, it's like it's a deal with the devil. You can,
yeah,
you might get something out of it, but you're also paying something, and that's part of the soul of the,
yeah,
the issue. You know,
yeah.
So I mean, there's always other arguments to be made against occupying the square too as public.
Yeah.
It's like, well, you're not the only people publicly who might
right.
want to use it.
Right.
Other people can't now. Whatever. You know.
Yeah.
If you go and sit in a park, then people can't go and bring their children. Though
yeah.
in winter in Buffalo, let's face it, not really an issue. And in even, you know, half of spring and half
yeah.
of fall. But still,
yeah.
you know.
Yeah, and I see that too, because I personally felt like a few times when I went over there and people kind of had condescending attitudes towards me when I tried to get involved. And I kind of felt like, well, you're occupying a public square. So who are you to kind of, you know, act like, I mean, they were starting to act territorial, like it was
mm-hmm.
their square. You know, and some people felt like, well, wait a minute, you know, this is a public square, and while you're here, you have to kind of respect the fact that you're in a public space. And they were very clean. They cleaned up after themselves. They actually kicked out people who were doing drugs and things like that, and they really were trying to be organized, but mm-hmm. it just seemed like they had formed their little city within the city, and they were just starting to get where, like, that was their home. But they, as far as I know, they weren't really doing anything for the city. You know, they didn't seem to be getting very active. After a while, they were just kind of fighting for their space there, but not really doing much to affect social change, was my feeling. And from talking to the people at the Occupy Western New York group, which those are basically people from Occupy Buffalo, but they gave themselves a different name, Occupy Western New York, because the people running things at Occupy Buffalo were mad at them for leaving and occupying in another space. I mean, it was just ridiculous,
yeah.
like, for people to...
What about the issue of women's opinions, like, not being taken seriously? I've read that on some of the Occupy websites that, you know, in various places, you know, there's been a lot of chauvinism and that women
mm-hmm.
are, you know, fighting back. And, you know, I've read some great stuff, some people saying some great stuff, you know, it's like,
well,
you know, we're part of you. Okay. We're the ones, you know,
yeah.
women, you know,
we're
in
half
a divorce,
the
women,
yeah,
we're half the population and you know, and we're, there's more of us in poverty, you know, than
yeah.
not. And, you
yeah.
know, so
actually most of the poor people in the world are women and people of color.
Yeah.
And that's true in our society as
and
well.
And children.
Yeah.
Who are under the protection, you know, more than half the time, less than full time, but more than half the time of their mothers. And
mm-hmm.
that's, you know, a lot of states still have laws that really favor the mother over the father, no matter what
mm-hmm.
the circumstances, too.
Mm-hmm.
So, I'm speaking a little low.
Yeah, because your voice is a little soft. I just want to make sure you picked
mm-hmm.
up. Yeah, it was something I brought up to them in the beginning.
And what was really interesting was, well, because I thought it was a real important thing, because I know you lent me that book about the 60s, and I was reading it in that book about how the women broke off and started the women's movement. So I brought it up to them. I said, you know, this movement seems like it's white male dominated, kind of like Wall Street, you know, and we really need to get women and minorities and other people involved. And, you know, and a lot of people were really open to that and nice about it, and they started a women's caucus. But there was just so much infighting going on. You know, what ended up happening was in the women's caucus, there were a lot of women. I was really surprised. Women were just venting and saying, you know, I felt like I was disrespected. No one's listening to me. These guys are not respecting my opinions. And I didn't realize there were so many women who were that unhappy. But then there were other women who were in disagreement with them, were saying, well, that's not true. You know, there's no discrimination against women in the Occupy movement.
Oh, the people that have to hold the line and stuff. You know, it's like, you can't. Yeah. Well, you know, the thing is, when anything like this is happening, when any big social ferment's going on, you've got to be able to throw off the stress, and you've got to be able to do it safely without people jumping on your your back for it. And then you can move on and get productive.
Right.
But if you can't even let people blow off the steam, you know, it's a stressful thing to go down there to put your life on hold, whatever it was before, however messed up it was before, to put your life on hold and do this and hold that line for social change. And then, you know, you're going to get more stress and, you know, and watch all the things that are happening.
You got to
let people vent. You know, you've got to let people you need to realize that's going to happen, and, you know.
Yeah, and I think, you know, you're right. I mean, I totally agree with that, because, you know, if you try to be an activist, it's so hard. I mean, you can lose your job.
Mm-hmm.
You know, your employer can fire you. A lot of employers are very conservative. Your family might disown you, you know. It can be very, very difficult to be a political activist, and there have been many famous activists throughout history who've committed suicide, as you probably know. And, you know, but I just thought it was an odd thing that, I mean, they started this women's caucus, but at the same time, it was divided between the women who didn't like the women who felt they were being discriminated against and the women who felt they were. And not only that, but there were some men in Occupy Buffalo, probably the perpetrators, who didn't like the fact that women had a women's caucus. And they wanted to sit in on it and spy on the women. And they requested that they be able to sit in and listen to us. And it just made some of us feel very uncomfortable, you know. And from what I heard, and I don't know if it's true, but one of the guys told me that there was a guy at Occupy Buffalo who was spying on the women's caucus, kind of like following them around, like listening in on their conversations and stuff like that. So it was kind of, you know, what are you guilty of? You know, why do you feel so threatened by the women having, you know? So, I mean, it was an interesting thing. And, you know, but, I mean, there was just a lot of that internal conflict. And I feel like it's sort of a reflection of our society, because there's so much dog-eat-dog-ishness in our society. And I feel like our society is so controlled by corporate America that people have just been conditioned to be competitive with each other in a negative way. You know, it just seems like there's a lot of conflict in our society as a whole. And I just wonder whether Occupy Buffalo's conflict were kind of a, you know, reflection of what is happening overall.
Well, you know, there's the whole idea that when there's a problem now, you just get fractious with people. You know, you point out their problem, you yell at them, and the idea of moderate response, I think, is kind of gone at this point, at least in the general social media and this and that, and, you know.
People aren't able to, I think, I wonder, too, like with technology, we're so used to going on the internet and text messaging each other and all that stuff, and I wonder if it's making us need instant gratification so much that we're having a hard time with, you know, working out conflicts with people, because that takes so much time and effort and imagination and, you know, years of watching TV, playing video games, text messaging, surfing the web. You know, we think we can click our mouse or click our remote control and get what we want right away, and that doesn't happen with people. You know, when people interact with each other, there has to be a certain amount of you know, diplomacy and patience and time and energy and imagination and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, well, but, you know, there's this great quote from Carrie Fisher from Postcards from the Edge, her first book. instant gratification takes too long.
Oh.
And, you know, that's, you know, this is from the mouth of a starlet, but that's really how almost most of the people I know think as far as getting what they want. I mean, you know, yeah, I didn't grow up with all this stuff. I didn't grow up with even a working TV most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a little different for me. I'm still sort of a dinosaur.
Oh.
But, I mean, I do go on the internet
mm-hmm.
a lot.
Mm-hmm.
But I keep it to, for sanity's sake, I keep it to certain areas, certain purposes
mm-hmm.
and all that. But, you know, I'm not being raised. I wasn't raised on it.
Mm-hmm.
That's the difference.
Yeah.
You know,
in a weird sort of way, that's sort of an advantage to poverty is that one thing you have to do when you're poor, if you can't afford those things, is you are going to have to learn how to, you know, to survive without that stuff and
yeah.
how to interact with other people. I mean, I'm always amazed about by why, you know, how when I take the bus or I take the subway or I'm walking down the street, I have to interact with such a variety of people and, you know, and sometimes very difficult people. And
yeah.
I often think that when I'm in a car, I lose that, and sometimes it's a good thing because, you know, I don't have to deal with the difficult people. But in a way, I'm kind of learning something when I have to go out there and I have to walk down those streets and take that bus and interact with all those crazy, eccentric people, because it's learning how to interact with all these different kinds of people.
Yeah.
And, you know, a long time ago, I used to have to go to a laundromat to do my laundry, and it was the same kind of thing. You know, where I was having to interact with all these people at this laundromat and people sometimes fighting with each other over, oh, that's my sock, you took my sock, or, you know, mm-hmm. I need that dryer, when are you going to be done? And
who took my stuff out while I was outside having a smoke or something?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And
yeah,
I
totally understand that. I mean, I myself, when I was little, you know, my mother left my father with six kids and
mm-hmm.
no money and nothing. And so we were on welfare for a while, and she, you know, made way to, you know, get a college degree and get a better job and get off it and all that. And, you know, the thing is, for my family, because of my father having been, you know, an alcoholic, even though he had a great job,
mm-hmm.
You know, he was blowing all his money all the time and, you know, not showing up, this and that, and all the things, whatever. Because this is before I was around or when I was very, very, you know, a baby.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, going on welfare was actually a step up for my brothers and sisters. You know what I mean?
Wow.
I mean, you know, the fact that I had hand-me-down clothes from Catholic Charities
mm-hmm.
made them envy me, you know.
Uh-huh.
And so, you know, it's a different perspective, you know. I mean, today I live in, you know, I definitely live well under the poverty line. And yet, it's so much more a genteel poverty than I knew before. You know, I mean, I have food to eat, you know, every day. I never have to. I will put it first, in fact. You know, I will not, but, you know, everything's always in flux. But that's, I realize that that's a kind of, I live in this luxurious poverty. I still have my own laptop or whatever, you know,
mm-hmm.
whatever I had to give up to get it. But
mm-hmm.
there's no amount of things that I can't do without if I don't have to. It's good to do that.
Yeah.
It's good to be able to do it.
It's good to, I think, to be poor temporarily.
Just yeah.
for a short time to build up your character, to learn how to overcome obstacles
yeah.
and deal with conflicts
yeah.
and develop empathy and compassion. But to be poor for a very long time.
It breaks your character. It can.
Yeah.
It can. It
yeah.
doesn't have to, but it can, certainly.
Yeah. It can totally destroy you. Well, that's another thing I'm interested in is how poverty affects people's mental health. Because I know for myself, I've been struggling for several years. Actually, I don't want to be divisive here, but our previous president's policies affected me directly. I mean, I can truthfully say his policies completely destroyed my life. And I won't go into detail there, but yeah, it was almost as though his policies were written to ruin me or something, you know. And my dreams were just completely shattered, and I've just been, you know, struggling ever since. And I found that once you hit the bottom, once you get on a certain level, it's real hard to climb up. You know, you just get where you've lost all your resources. You know, you just don't have things that other people take for granted. You know, they're living in a nice house, they've got a fax machine and a computer and a car, and they've got all these things, and they just assume you've got it. Well, sometimes people don't have those things, and, you know, it just becomes difficult to climb up. And the other thing I noticed, it's for me, it's been hard to have friends and to socialize because basically, like, first of all, I've had a lot of friends judge me, you know, mm-hmm. and try to suggest that it's my fault. You know, I mean, for example, I've had friends tell me that poverty is a spiritual thing. I had a friend tell me to go to Debtors Anonymous meetings. They don't have them in Buffalo, but in some parts of the country, they do have them.
Thank you so much.
I've gone to several of them, and they're like a 12-step program for people in debt. But it got to be so irritating to me, really, because I would go there, and, you know, they wanted me to say, hello, my name is Buffy Lowe, and I am an under-earner, or I am a debtor, or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and my response was, hello, my name is Buffy Lowe, and I'm a very intelligent, well-educated person, and I'm a writer and a musician and an actress and filmmaker, and this is what I do, and I'm just having trouble earning a living at it. And the people at the Debtors Anonymous meeting got mad at me for doing that, because I wasn't really, you know, labeling myself as a debtor or under-earner mm-hmm. or whatever. But I kept trying to explain to people, I don't want to be an under-earner. I'm not... It's not a spiritual thing. It's not a psychological thing. It has nothing to do with anything I'm doing or saying. I mean, I present myself very well when I apply for jobs, and I know this for a fact because I've done temp work in offices, mm-hmm. and I've seen people's resumes. You know, I had to file them in some of my jobs. I've seen the kinds of resumes and cover letters that employers get, and I know that I'd sent out really nice, well-written resumes, cover letters, and I know that I presented myself well, but the reality is the jobs aren't out there, at least not for some of us, you know, not in my field, you know, and I graduated from a top college with a high grade point average, and I am, you know, I'm a very intelligent person, you know, I mean, I made a documentary film about homelessness, and I started it while I was homeless. I think that's pretty impressive,
yeah,
you know, and I started this podcast, and I'm poor. I don't have anything. I have a computer because people gave me computers. And one of my computers I got for $20 at a garage sale. So, you know, I mean, it's not like I'm a wealthy person, but I'm doing the best I can with what I have. But I think I've proven, you know, just as you have, you know, as a published writer, you know, that, you know, I mean, really, like, what is it with these people who think there's something wrong with you when you're poor? They assume that you're poor because you're abusing drugs or alcohol, or your character's poor. You're just not a nice person. God hasn't blessed you.
Right.
God doesn't love you enough.
Yeah, I just saw a great quote the other day saying, you know, if hard work and determination were all it took to be wealthy,
mm-hmm.
you know what I mean, then all the women in Africa would be millionaires.
Oh, that's awesome. Do you know who said that?
No, it was on Facebook.
Oh.
Sorry.
You are a computer nerd. I knew it all along.
Yeah, but it's pretty recent. I mean, I've actually, because I've always been allied myself romantically with computer nerds,
mm-hmm.
Even before they were a huge, you know, even before they came out of the closet and said, we're geeks and we're proud, I had a computer in my house before most people had computers in their houses, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't use it. And then, you know, eventually I use it for a word processing program, really, until I got sick 7 years ago. Actually, the year before I got sick was when I started using a computer on any regular basis for anything except writing my papers in college.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And even then, it took about 4 more years before I became where I actually went any place on the internet. And it's still nothing to what other people, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have a big life there.
Well, there's so much to do on the internet. I think it's like...
it's fun box.
Yeah,
it's a fun box.
There's so much there. Like, you can meet people from all over the world.
Yeah, I have some communities. Actually, that's what I had to do.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I went there. Because I actually, for the first time in my, you know, life as an outsider trying to get in always and never really getting there, I actually found some communities,
mm-hmm.
you know, that because they only have this tenuous connection over the computer, actually accept me.
Wow.
Or, I mean, you know, they accept me as what I am, more or less, as I can, and I try and present myself as honestly as possible.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, and that's a good thing. That's what I think, you know, a lot of us are on there for that reason. But
I think you've heard of SOPA and PIPA, right?
I sent letters to that, too. I was, you know, and I...
Piracy.
You know, yeah.
Stealing information. You know, they're so worried about our sharing information. I think that they're just worried that we'll communicate with each other and start to like each other as humans rather than fight with each other.
Divide and conquer.
Yeah, exactly. And I feel like that's what happened in Occupy Buffalo. There's, you know, and hopefully it's not happening at other Occupies. But, you know, as humans, we need to sort of love each other in a general sort of way. It's not as though you're going to agree with other people on everything. Some of us have more liberal, progressive views. Some have conservative views. Some are very religious. Some are not religious at all. But, you know, I mean, there's it's like what Cornel West, I don't know if you ever heard him talk, but he talks about love. And, you know, he talks, and he basically says, if you love other people, you don't want to see them suffer. You don't want to see them poor and struggling. You know, when you love your fellow human being, it's going to bother you. You know, when you see a homeless person, your thought should be, oh, I'm so sorry that you're homeless. Not necessarily that you have money to give them or that you can even help them. But as a human being, you should at least feel, I'm sorry. You know, I mean, that should be our instinct, not, oh, what did you do to get yourself into that situation? Mm-hmm. You know, that's just not a normal human response.
Well, at least we don't want it to be a normal human response. And I don't think it is. I mean, the problem. Whenever you can put everybody else except a few into the other, then you don't have to, you know, you don't have to face them. You know, you got to meet people one-on-one. You've got to, you know, you've got to be, if you're going to be part of the world, be part of the world, you know. Mm-hmm. And you're not going to like all parts. But like you said, you know, the more you interact, the more you get the ability to interact. And,
it's not easy for us in our instant gratification-oriented society.
Yeah, and that's why you get depressed. You know, you can't, you know, you don't have any money. You don't have any place to go. Now I'll reveal it here. Oh, big deal. But that I'm, you know, I have this weird illness that, you know, is pretty rare and, you know, almost no one's ever heard of. Mm-hmm. And, you know, our celebrity spokesperson is, Fabio, which is great, but doesn't make for a lot of understanding what's happening with it. He's trying to bring attention. I appreciate that. But it's isolating, you know, when you're sick, and you know, so many of us are now, you know, and there's things that have led to that, you know.
Yeah.
What I mean?
Do you think the chemicals put in our air, food, and water might be causing your illness and other illnesses? And I'm sure you've heard about the kids recently in one of the schools locally, having all kinds of muscle tics or whatnot, and the doctors are claiming
Tourette's-like.
Yeah, Tourette's-like symptoms, and the doctors are claiming that they're just influenced by other kids who are sick, that it's all in their heads or something. It's psychological, and are trying to write it off as not having anything to do with the school. I'm just really appalled by that, you know, that all these kids could be getting sick, and that sounds very, very serious if they're having Tourette's-like symptoms. That sounds like a brain disorder, something affecting their brains.
Mm-hmm.
I find it to be horrifying that the school and the doctors that they were sent to see are trying to claim that it's all in their heads or something, you know, that they're just influenced by the other kids, and that's why they're acting that way. And so the parents are demanding further investigation into it. But it just makes me, when we think about, you know, the chemicals, the substances put in our air, food and water, all kinds of things, just even this microphone. The computer, I bought a radio once that had a note on it that said, warning, the chemicals in the cord of this radio may be hazardous to your health.
Well, do you know that if you put green plants nearby, they can actually help detoxify the air around a screen?
Oh, really?
Yeah. So, you know, keep some healthy green plants around by your computer on your desk.
Oh, that's
good idea. On, you know, you better have them on non-leaking trays, you know what
I mean? Yeah, right, right.
But actually that helps clean, and, you know, because green plants, they do that for us all the time, and they do it for free, and they don't ask anything, but
they're not capitalists.
A little water and some Jobs. Yeah, exactly.
They're not capitalists.
They're not capitalists. Well, you know, but you're mentioning this thing, and I'm remembering how, I don't know whether it was in the 1930s or 40s or something like that, that, you know, down south, you know, groups of children in, you know, institutions and orphanages and stuff, you know, this group of kids was, they were all acting like they had brain damage. And it gradually, after the, you know, after a gradual time of being on the regular diet, all right, the diet then was basically cornmeal mush and, you know, fat back, you know, and that's what it was all the time, because that was cheap and it was available, and that's what they had to feed them. And when, you know, examined, you know, this doctor said, hey, I can't remember his name now, I'm sorry, I'm bad with names, you know, and tried something different, come to find out these kids were missing, you know, some important nutrients. When they added in some greens and a couple other vegetables, gradually that brain damage cleared, you know, and they realized it was, and it's a condition called pellagra. You know, I mean, there's all kinds of things like that, rickets and this and that, and there's no reason why some of the, you know, heavy duty, we've got really, we still have, they still haven't really cleaned up all the love canal stuff, and that's not the only site like that around here. So we've got all this stuff. Yeah, I grew up in this, you know, and the fact that I grew up on fresh vegetables and little, some very small amounts of fresh meat, but fresh meat and stuff like that, that, you know, not all the kind of chemical junk that kids eat today. Even when people were eating a lot of that stuff, my mother didn't do that. Mm-hmm. She cooked from scratch all the whole way, you know. But how clean can it be? How good can a fresh vegetable be if, you know, it's picked from the ground where, you know, where poisons have been dumped for, you know, 50 years?
And why is it that it's the poor areas that are so polluted, too?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, does Beverly Hills have, maybe they do, there's a lot of smog.
Oh, yeah, they have their, yeah, but they're also, some of, they're above it. Cause they're above a lot.
They're better than us because they work harder, they're more determined, and they pray, and God's blessed them, and they have positive attitudes. We're being negative because we're talking about poverty and inequality and injustice, so we're being negative. We're not being positive. Haven't you heard of the law of attraction, the secret? You know, we're just focusing on negative things, and that's why we're poor.
And that's why we can't afford to spend $5,000 on a tote bag and carry it around and get photographed in it.
Yeah, because we're so negative, and what else is wrong with us? We're negative, we're not working hard enough, we're lazy, and we don't want to work. We're just looking for a handout. That's why we're on this podcast right now. Please send us some money, except we won't give you our address.
That's exactly, when I first got sick with this disease, which I'll tell you, though you won't remember, people, is called dermatomyositis.
Ooh.
What a mouthful, yeah.
That's tough.
Yeah, well, that basically just says, you know, that it's inflammation-based, it's thought to be an autoimmune disorder.
Oh.
Basically, your immune system attacks you. So I'm on drugs all the time to depress my immune system, so that, and then when I get a bug, I have to go off them and risk a flare back, and which means that I get so weak that I can't walk, swallow, get in and out of bed, take care of myself, any of those things. And if left untreated, you die. Actually, Florence Olivier almost died from this.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
But anyway, when I first got sick with this really nasty thing, you know, I was on the hospital's dime, and, you know, I got so sick of, you know, I'm sitting there with all these other people, waiting in the pharmacy because they would only dole things out through the hospital pharmacy, you know, that our doctor. So we have to wait maybe 3 hours to get a prescription filled, and we can't go anywhere. We have to sit there and wait in line for that amount of time, okay, to get stuff. And people are telling me, you know, saying, not knowing, oh, you know, all these people on the public dime, you know, they've got it so easy. I'm going, well, you know, sitting in a nasty hospital room with a bunch of people you don't know who might not even speak your language isn't really all that much of a picnic, you know what I mean?
Right.
If you think people are doing this because they want to, you're out of your mind. And I can tell you, because I went through it, I'm in the machine now, and I don't like it. It's not fun. It was not easy to have myself declared disabled at, you know, the age of 40-something. That's, you know, I was like, no, what, I can't do it. I held off for like 3 or 4 years of this disease before I let myself do that, you know, dealing without having any income, you know, and not knowing what to do and having to scrape by even worse than I am now just for that. And that's, you know, it's a horrible thing to have to say, yeah, I'm no longer like the rest of you. So
I'm just doing a sound check right now to see if our sound is.
Is our sound not good?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. There's a delay.
Yeah.
Okay, so we are being recorded. Okay, so that's good. I just wanted to check on that because sometimes, usually we get a few listeners, but that's okay. People will download us our recorded broadcast later. But, I mean, similarly, I had a temp job at Heap, and people would come in and it would be like 40 below out or whatever, and their heat had been shut off because they couldn't afford to pay their bill on time. A lot of people think that that's illegal, but it's not. The gas company can shut your heat off in the middle of the winter if you don't pay your bill on time. So people were coming in, and we were like, well, why didn't you come show up sooner, you know, before the winter hit and things got really cold out? Oh, I was embarrassed. I didn't want to. Like people, a lot of people just are so reluctant to apply for assistance, you know, because they feel so bad. And, you know, it often makes things worse. I mean, I think that there are probably some people who end up homeless because they didn't apply for assistance when they needed it.
Yeah.
And then things get so bad. You know?
I didn't last year. They were on me, and I should have, and I didn't. And it did help us get, you know, farther down in the hole. And that's, you know, it's hard. It's hard not to do it. Of course, when you've got a bunch of things, well, that's and a lot of people do too.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just that they might need to apply for HEAP or something, but they've also got medical problems, this and that problems, or they're looking for jobs and not being able to find one, and dealing with the depression and all the other stuff. When you know, it's being messed up like that is like a really badly paid part time job or a not paid part time job where you have to actually put out money to try and get something to come in, and it's not good. But, you know, it's funny that you said that about HEAP, because the thing is, NYPIRG, some time ago, you know, I think it was like 20 years ago, I thought they did actually pass a bill that got a bill passed that they can't shut off your heat if you tell them, hey, blah, blah, but you have to know. You have to know that they can't do that, and you have to say, no, you can't do that because it's blah, blah,
but
blah.
But I think it may have changed, though.
Maybe it did.
I think
you know.
The laws may have changed on that, because I just know that there were quite a few people who had their heat shut off, and that was our job, was to help people get their heat back on. In fact, I remember...
Once you get it off, then you have that huge fee, too, to turn it back on.
Exactly. And one woman who I went out of my way to help her, very nice lady, she had been a nurse, and she felt embarrassed that because I guess she'd always had a lot of money, but like you, she became disabled. She came down with some illness. And we should talk about that, too. They tried to take away her disability. George Bush, I believe, did that. He made changes in the disability laws. But anyway, so she had no heat, and she just felt so terrible about applying. I had to practically convince her. She came into the HEAP office, and she was like, well, you know what, I'm really not in as much need as these other people. And I basically had to, even though she came in there, she was ready to leave, and I had to convince her, no, you need help, you have no heat. And she was so grateful that, you know, I ran into her a few times in passing afterwards, and, you know, she told me later on, like a few weeks later, that it actually, she qualified for the assistance, but it took, I think she said a few weeks or something for them to get her heat put back on. And this was in the winter. And so even though she qualified for the assistance, they didn't just put her heat back on, you know.
Yeah.
So it still took a while. So I thought that was interesting. But that disability thing, you know, what I've heard, and correct me if I'm wrong, but what I heard is that George W. made changes in the disability law, or his administration did, so that it's harder for people to get on disability.
Yeah.
And now if you work at all, they'll take it away from you. And that just happened to one of my coworkers. She's very, very ill, in very poor shape. You can really tell by looking at her.
You have to report all your income. I'm not on actually I'm disabled, but I'm on SSI, not SS, you know, D.
Yeah.
But you do have to report your income. You have to tell them. And if it gets past a certain amount, they're either going to take you off, they're going to take it out of your check.
Well, basically what they're doing now is if you work at all, they're saying, oh, you can work. You must not be disabled. So they're saying to her, you know, you seem to be able to work, so you should just get a full-time job and, you know, go off disability. And they cut her benefits. So she's quitting the job and leaving the state to go live with a friend out of state who is able to provide her with a place to live. And so... she may just not work anymore now.
mm-hmm.
And just try to get our disability back. But, I mean, like, how does that benefit our society? So basically you want to discourage people from working,
yeah.
you know, and tell people, yeah. oh, you were working. And then at the same time, you know, they'll look at us and say, what's wrong with you? Why aren't you working? You know?
Oh, yeah.
But at the same time, if you do work, you lose all your benefits. And
yeah.
if you've got a lot of health problems, you know, and you need regular treatment, and even with the disability benefits, she wasn't able to get all the treatment that she needed for all of her medical problems. There were just things that, you know, medicines and things like that that she couldn't afford. And I might add that this job does not pay well. It's only a minimum wage job.
Yeah.
So, you know, and she was working there part-time and, you know, but yeah, I mean, that's the way, you know, you can be disabled, but you have to prove you're disabled.
Yeah.
And you, you know, if you do any kind of work, then they will say, oh, you're able to work, huh? Well, you know, and that's, if there's just like this meanness behind any kind of any kind of assistance you get from the government.
Well,
there's
that's
just
it.
Meanness.
It's, you know, I don't even know if it's meanness so much as it's like layers of bureaucracy. I mean, it's this whacked out system where, you know, they need, I mean, last year, Heap was calling me at home and sending me, trying desperately to get me to apply for it. And I think it was because if they don't get a certain number of people on it, then the overall grant will get cut for it. And then the next year when it's really bad, they won't have enough, you know what I mean? So they're trying to keep the amount that they need, you know what I mean, up. But, you know, and I think the whole thing is like that. There's, you know, there's this little add-on that was made and this little idea and this idea. I mean, you
but
know, there's a ticket to work program, yeah.
But
and it is. It's about getting you
yeah.
into those kind of jobs. No.
But I mean, it's all with an idea behind
well,
it that if you're poor, it's your own fault. Like the whole idea behind all this bureaucracy is, you bum.
Yeah.
Why
well.
Are you applying for assistance? You know, like that the whole, like it's all set up to like punish you in a way, like.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because they're worried that you're secretly a wealthy person and you're pretending you need.
Yeah, there is that. I mean,
there's
definitely that idea. You know, what do you have? You know, I've got nothing. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I left my 20-year-old car in Indiana
but
when
you
I left
have a
Indiana.
House.
I don't own it.
Are they
going to
take it from you?
No, I don't own it.
Oh,
well,
okay, well
they do want to take it from us, but
they do.
Yeah, and the mortgage company has been trying almost since day one. And I'll tell you about that.
Oh, yeah,
and
you're
but
talk
and
about
this
that.
This whole you know the like on SSI I keep getting these messages about the ticket to work program. Now I went to college for creative writing and philosophy
mm-hmm.
for more than 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll be damned if I'm going to go and spend my life as a clerk
mm-hmm.
at Goodwill. I am not telling you there's anything wrong with it. If it's good for you, it's good for you. But that would drive me insane. It's not what I trained for. It's not a job that I could stand
right.
without going insane after
right.
a while. But that said, if I had to, I'd do anything I could to keep myself fed and stuff. But, you know, very soon, if I was doing something like that, life would not be worth living.
Right.
You know,
right.
I've got bigger plans for myself, and I'm working on them, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
In the meantime, I can't anyway. I literally can't work because...
Mm-hmm.
You know, I never know from hour to hour, day to day, what's going to be happening with my body. But if I was, I certainly wouldn't be doing it through that program. I'd have to find something else and report and because, you know, what you know, that assumes that everybody's at the same
right.
level of skill and knowledge, and that's all you can do. You know, that's
but
not
really,
good enough. You know,
see, I think that you're probably not a conspiracy theorist like I am.
No,
I am a conspiracy theorist. I do believe that they do this because they want to demoralize us. They want to demean us. I think that they believe, those in power think, if you're poor, you're a bum. You know, and we want to keep you down because, you know, let's face it. Instead of sending you to a welfare to work program or something like that, they could send you to college. Why don't
yeah.
they do that? Why don't they say, you know what? We see that you're an intelligent, creative, talented person. We're going to pay you through to get your PhD, and then you'll have a PhD. You'll be a college professor. You'll never need to apply for assistance again. But no, that's not what they do. They prepare people for low-paying jobs.
Right.
I interviewed one.
You can work at McDonald's for the rest of your life. Why don't you want to?
Yeah. What's wrong with you that you don't want to work at some minimum wage job? You know. Like this guy I interviewed for my documentary on homelessness, it was like, well, they can get jobs, you know? And I'm like, well, you just told me that homeless people are making all this money begging for money on the street. If they're making so much money begging for money on the street, why would they want to work at McDonald's? Well, there's more dignity in that. I'm like, really? If I could make more money begging on the street than I could working at McDonald's, I'd definitely beg on the street. I mean, I'm sorry, but, you know, I don't really think there's any dignity in working in some job like at McDonald's or whatever, especially when you have a college degree and you're an intelligent person, you know, and you've got all these skills. It's
any job really only has as much dignity as you feel in it. And I've worked at Wendy's, so, mm-hmm. you know, I can say this.
Well, I mean, for you
I didn't feel it was any big dignity. Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean?
That's it. I liked cleaning houses better mm-hmm. than I did working in those kind of places. Mm-hmm. And and some of you say, oh, well, you're cleaning this house with four toilets. But, well, you know what? Mm-hmm. But my bosses respect me. I'm willing to go and have some privations to be in a job that doesn't drive me insane.
You've had a boss who respects you? Wow.
Yeah, I've actually been, once you find one, you find mm-hmm. more. And I have had quite a few. Nothing's perfect, but, mm-hmm. but, you know, I had to work in private homes and I had to not have any health benefits and I had to do mm-hmm. deal with a lot of, you know, things you can't have for that too. But, you know, I was sane.
Yeah. I mean, I wonder, like, how do you feel about, like, I don't want to use any nasty language here, but the people who say, what's wrong with you? Why did you major in English, namely me, or philosophy, or why did you study the liberal arts in college? Yeah. Why didn't you study something more practical? And you try to explain to these people, really? Do you really think that everyone could just go to college and study to be an engineer or study to be a doctor or something? Do you really think we don't need English majors? We don't need history majors? We don't need philosophy majors? Do you really think we could run a society without the liberal arts? But there are a lot of people who do, you know, and they totally disrespect the liberal arts. And I think artists and creative people in general. And guess what? That is actually one of the early warning signs of fascism, is disdain for the arts.
Oh, yeah.
Disdain for education. So how do you...
When people start burning books, then you know, you're in for a problem. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Well, that's it. The same people who say that are also the same people that you know, think that, you know, they can give their kids self-esteem by saying, oh, well, you get a birthday present on your sister's birthday, too, you know, because everybody should have everything equal. And they're the same people that say anyone can be anything they want to be. And that is bulk, okay? Mm-hmm. Anybody cannot be anything they want to be. There's mm-hmm. always disparity. There always has been, and there always will, mm-hmm. you know.
There's a tremendous amount of discrimination. I'm glad you brought that up, because that is something I ran into so much of that when I lived in Hollyweird. Hollyweird. So much. I mean, I was, like, so enthusiastic, like, stupidly, I believed in the American dream. Yeah, that was my big mistake in life. That's why I'm poor, because I believed in the American dream. That was my character flaw. And, you know, I worked so hard. You know, I was taking my acting classes. I was getting my writing published. I was playing my guitar out in public places. Like, I was doing all the quote-unquote right things. And I had proof of that, because I went to see a career counselor just to find out, what am I doing wrong? Why am I not successful? And she said, you're doing all the right things. You just need patience. And she was into all that positive thinking mm-hmm. stuff, you know. Think positive. Think happy thoughts. Well, whatever. But what I saw in Hollywood was, you know, like, people who were just born with connections. And because they were born with these connections, they got into all these, they got all these breaks, you know. And they weren't more talented than I was or harder working or anything. In fact, they often take things for granted because things come so easily for them.
Yeah.
And I also saw, like, a lot of, you know, people who just wanted to exploit people like me, you know, like perverts, dirty old men, you know, I mean, really, men made me offers, you know, I'll buy you a car, I'll do this for you, I'll buy you groceries, you know, I'll take care of you, you know.
I'll do that. Just give me this, just give me that, you know. Sure.
I wasn't willing to play that game, you know. I wanted to make it based on my own hard work, that American dreams lie, you know, that if I worked hard and paid my dues, I'd be successful. And, you know, I just had to find out the hard way. It's just not true. I mean, you can be talented, intelligent, whatever, even have a pretty face, whatever. But, you know, if you're not willing to play that game, it kind of seems to me like there are the Anna Nicole Smiths, you know, the women who sleep with the dirty old men to work their way up. And Marilyn Monroe apparently did the same thing, you know. And we're taught to look down on those women. But if you aren't one of those women, if you aren't willing to do that, then where do you go?
And look what happened to them.
Yeah, right.
They didn't exactly end up, they both were gone at an early age, so that's just, good examples. it's tough, everybody, I belong to a couple different writing groups online and as well as in real life, and, everybody in the arts is having tough, if you go through and you do it the standard way, okay, I'm going to go and get a degree, it doesn't make you a writer. It doesn't make you a published writer. It doesn't mean anything until you show your stuff. And then you've got to deal with marketing. It used to be writers went through publishing, houses. Then agents were added in more and more and more. That's fine. Now you basically have to do, 90% of the promotion, no matter who's publishing your book. Even if for some lucky kind of chance you get a good agent who loves your material, promotes you, gets you a good contract and stuff, you still have to have a presence, you still have to have some creds. You have to already have the goods of being famous before you do anything for it. And I'm not suggesting, I don't think most people don't go into writing for fame, and it's a good thing because most people will not get it no matter what. But and that's applicable to all the arts. But then again, you've got the other side. You've got the fads, the fads in poetry, the this and that and the other. I mean, no one gets rich writing poetry.
Right, yeah.
No one has, no one will.
But, I think back in the 60s, from what I was reading, poetry was more popular.
Yeah.
At that time.
But it wasn't exactly a way you're going to make all the people we know as famous poets from then, they all had day jobs. What I mean?
I wonder, about a society that doesn't value the arts, that makes you a starving artist. And that's thinking outside the box. When I talk to people about, well, that's just the way it is. Well, I know that's the way it is. My question is, why is it that way? Why can't we have a society in which people can be artists, can be creative, and still earn a decent living? Why can't we have a society that allows anybody to earn a decent living? Why would you say somebody has to major in engineering or medicine or law or some specific field? And anyway, it's not true, because I've met people who've studied law who are, and you probably know,
a bunch of
lawyers.
I know MBAs who are walking around and they can't get jobs.
Right.
So
there's no real practical profession, but still, like, why would you say, like, everyone has to major in this certain subject, or everybody has to be, to fit in some role? I mean, that's fascism. That's a fascist way of thinking. That's not a democratic way of thinking. And in a democratic society, we have a variety of people with a variety of interests and talents, and we don't say to people, you all have to be engineers, you all have to major in science, in chemistry or biology or math, or we embrace the diversity because we can learn from all of it. And I think artists and creative people think outside the box and use their imagination and are good at solving problems. And sometimes technical people are too fixed on doing things the way that they've always been done. And there are strengths and weaknesses in, different ways of thinking in different disciplines.
Yeah. Well, and engineering in general, though, I mean, it attracts people with highly creative minds, but their minds are creative and different, regimented. I know, because I'm an INTP in Myers-Briggs, so technically I could have, if I'd have had the breaks, if I'd known what it was, I would have been drawn to it. But the truth is that, the people that are very tip-top, they don't want 60 million engineers walking around. They don't want 60 million people who are good, who are primed with information. You wouldn't be able to get into to the top levels anyway. No matter who, what I mean? There's not going to be that many people who can get in to that top level and get the really great jobs and that, and the really, great opportunities. There's still networks, there's still societies, there's things you have to join, there's groups you have to join, and most of us aren't going to be invited. And if we try and bang down the walls, they're going to say, okay, well, fine, you can come in to this. And then they're just going to go and have their little, old boys meeting, so to speak, somewhere else.
Yeah, and then that's exactly what it is. It's an old boys club in our society. And really, if you weren't, I, just in my opinion, again, I am more of a conspiracy theorist, and I think if you weren't born with money and connections, forget it. You know, I think our system is set up to keep you in your place. You come from a poor family, you'll stay poor. Lower middle class, you'll stay lower middle class. Middle class, you'll end up poor.
Yeah, that's
the way things are right now.
That's it.
No more
middle
class.
Yeah, they're trying to, you know, it's trying. Well, the thing is that as people get poorer, they stop being able to buy smart and do the best financial things anyway. You know how it is. If you're living from paycheck to paycheck, you know that you're spending, you know, a little more, you know, like $2 more for less than, you know, if you could only spend $10 more on that box of whatever, mm-hmm. then you'd have enough to last you this. But because you have to mm-hmm. deal with the cash in hand,
right.
and you always have it going out in so many directions,
mm-hmm.
you have to do smaller and smaller and smaller.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't do that, you know, or you get places, you know, you get boggled and people make you spend money on, or coerce you, not make you, but it is a form of coercion.
Mm-hmm.
They get you to spend more money than you really can have on something that you can't use in time. I mean, you know, day to day. You know, what we all need is we need more things that we're all a part of that we can all take from. We need things like more community gardens, you know, more
Wait, are you
community our resources. Hey.
This is the end of part one of Occupy Buffalo, Occupy Yourself. February 5th, 2012 broadcast. Check us out on TalkShoe.com. Search for Occupy Buffalo.